you know, the colours, the paint, the black and white, the lighthouse dwellings that are there, all of that is very typical of the type of houses that we lived in when we were kids. Lighthouses, the lighthouse dwellings for the families. So it's quite typical. It's not a typical lighthouse tower itself, the Hook. It's an older one. It's the oldest one in the country, apparently. But yes, its situation, jutting into the sea, surrounded by the walls, the whitewash, the design of the lightkeepers' houses, all of that is very typical. Yeah, I would feel a connection with this type of place, definitely. Yeah.
This is the original building here.
Yeah. Oh, yes. This is the building
that's built in 1174, and structurally hasn't changed since. And these are the ceilings, as you can see, are a very unique feature. They are corbelled. They're a corbelled dome ceiling. They were a particularly Norman type of building. And this place was built by William Marshall, Earl of Pembroke. And he founded the Port of the Ross. And he built this place as a fire tower. And it's still on the old charts. 1600, around that time, as a fire tower. And the monks who have been out on the point here from 452, Marshall moved them in here, and they were the forerunners, the lightkeepers, until the middle of the 1500s, when Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries. The monks disappeared from here at that stage. And Irish Lights then came into being about, about 1868, and they split from the Ballast Office, which controlled the Port of Dublin, and we've been under the control of Commissioners of Irish Lights since. Now, do you want to call them?
I was born at Galleyhead Lighthouse, and we then moved to Ballycotton. And the first lighthouse I actually lived at or have a memory of would be Clare Island Lighthouse. There were a limited number of small island lighthouses generally, where the wife of the keeper was the female assistant keeper. And so that my mother was also a lighthouse keeper. But really it goes back to my great-great-grandfather. It was just part of life. It was the thing to do. I just didn't consider doing anything else. That was it. You just grew up with it, and that it was the thing to do.
Well, the fact that I suppose that I was born under the light, you might say, of the Hook here, and thanks for all young fellas, I was attracted to uniforms, and I saw fellas going down on bicycles at that time, wearing their uniforms, and of course then my father was in the lightships, so there was he would have been the first of the family to be in Irish Lights, and I suppose that it followed on from there. But mainly I used to come up here, you know, I went to school with the kids of the families from here, and you would be up here after school playing with them, and they would be down around the village. And that's the way I suppose I became associated with the lighthouse here and the light service. And I remember one of the AKs here, a fellow called Eugene Gillen, he's gone to his reward since giving me a cap badge, and I thought it was the most prized possession that I could have.
My father was a light keeper, lighthouse keeper. My father was a lighthouse keeper, and after many years on a variety of lighthouses throughout the country and around the coast, he died literally, I'd say, within a month of his due retirement. He was due to retire, I think, in March or early April, and he died in February. So he had almost come ashore before he died.
I hadn't an idea about what the lighthouse service was. In fact, I always thought a king and queen lived in the lighthouse in the bay because it was all painted white and there were princesses and everything there. That's when I used to view it from the front door when I was young. The first I began to know about the lighthouses was I met Brendan, my husband. He first told me about the lighthouse service. He told me that he had passed the examination and he would be called up sometime to be a lighthouse keeper. So that day eventually came in 1943. He was called to the lighthouse service. We got married anyway in 1946. And he was now stationed at Rathlin O'Byrne, a lighthouse out on an island off Donegal. And the houses, the dwellings, as they were called, for that lighthouse were in Glencullum Kill. So I was living in Galway, married him and went to live in Glencullum Kill. Oh, I didn't know what I was letting myself in for. And I didn't understand it either. The rule was that you were left there for so long and you were transferred to another station. There was a whole change around the coast. Different people went to different places and they had their own system of moving you. And we were there for 3 years. Our first baby was born there and born at home without anybody being with me. And it's buried in Glencullum Kill, a wee boy.
It was a very tough job for men to do, and it was very tough on the families, it was very tough on the wives that they left behind. I think it took a particular type of person. There were romantic aspects to it, there has to have been. I think that there's a certain security and about towers, about lighthouse towers, and there's the kind of naval tradition of, you know, keeping brass polished and keeping all engines in working order, and the lantern tower itself at the top of the tower. There's something very solitary about that, about the buildings themselves, and the men that worked in them obviously would have been affected by that too. But I would see, I think as a son of a lighthouse keeper, I would see more of the non-romantic side of it, I have to say. You know, I think, as I say, it took a particular type of person to be able to cope with solitude on isolated rocks and be able to step away from their family and, you know, survive out there. And then come ashore. You know, it really was two lives, I feel, that they were leading. They wouldn't have continued doing it if there wasn't some romantic element to it. But I would see it as tough more than romantic, really.
Initially, it went with boat reliefs, which, when the ships were leaving, you would do, technically, you went on duty for 6 weeks. but because of weather conditions, you could be 3 months. And then you came home and you had 14 days at home, and then you went back for another 6 weeks. Your function was to safeguard the mariner. And that consisted of, first of all, maintaining the light and the fog signal at maximum capability and power. And for that reason, there was 4 hours maintenance each day. And that would consist of making sure the light was working to maximum capacity, cleaning the engines, making sure the engines were ready at any moment for fog signal or whatever. And again, of course, maintaining the structure to some extent. And again, maintaining the landings and the equipment, derricks and that kind of thing, for landing stores and indeed men on some of the rocks. And then, of course, yes, you did 4 hours duty. Our watches would start, for instance, at 6 o'clock in the morning. One man would be on from 6 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock in the morning. And he then stayed on that duty, and again 6 o'clock in the evening to 10 o'clock at night. He stayed on that duty for 1 week. And the watches were changed then on Sunday. The next watch then, of course, was 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock. Morning and afternoon and night and early morning again. And then the other watch, the graveyard watch as we used to call it, 2 o'clock to 6 o'clock. That was 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 6 o'clock in the evening and 2 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the morning.
You had three categories of stations in the main. You had the likes of the Hook here, which was termed as a land station. Then you had the islands, like Arran Mór, Arran Islands, Rathlin. But then you had the outlying rocks. And the outlying rocks were pretty hostile and very isolated. I suppose I did 12 years on the Bull Rock. The Bull Rock was off of Dersey Island, down on the Cork-Kerry border. And that was just a rock, 300 feet out of the water, with a cave through the middle of it, big enough that fishing boats could go through the cave. But in bad weather at night, the roar of the sea through that place, it sounded like the depths of hell. And when I went there in 1963, I was appointed there, and the helicopters weren't introduced until 69. It was boat reliefs at the time, and your chances of being relieved on time during the winter months was pretty slim. And I remember on one occasion, I think about 1964, going back to Castletown the day after Boxing Day and not getting back here home again until the end of March. We were 3 weeks, I think, in Castletown waiting to get out, and then I was 9 weeks and 2 days on the rock. I suppose you wouldn't step out on the Bull 3 days in the year. In the midsummer, even. You had a rise and fall there all the time. There was about 20 square yards of vegetation on the top of it. But the only walk you had was there was a passageway down the front, and that meant retracing your steps every, it's about 20 yards long. That was the only exercise you would get on it. You adjusted. You had diverse personalities in the service, but you just had to adjust, otherwise it would be intolerable situation on a rock, and you had to anticipate fellas' moods, and try and work around them, and work with them. It was the only way for a working environment.
When I came on the scene, when I was born first. We were based in Clifton in County Galway at the time, and he was on a lighthouse nearby. But shortly after that, we moved to Valentia Island in Kerry, and again, we were in the dwellings on the island. He was away in a lighthouse. Now, I don't have memories of the man at all at that point, but we were transferred then to Inishowen, which was a beautiful land station lighthouse in Donegal. And yeah, my earliest memories of my father are of us living as a family on that lighthouse, the lighthouse next door to that. There were actually two towers in Inishowen, but the smaller tower was right next to the house. We were living in the house right beside the lighthouse. It was a very idyllic place to live, and very self-sufficient people, both my mother and father. They would have grown lots of vegetables, would have had wonderful vegetable gardens, gathering seaweed to fertilise for potatoes in another field and so on. But they were very happy memories, I must say, early months.
And straight from Glencolumbkill down to the Skelligs down in Kerry. Well, not onto the Skelligs. I lived on Valench Island. And Brendan went away to the Skelligs, which was 15 miles out at sea. And he had to go out there for 6 weeks. But it was seldom that he was 6 weeks away. It usually ran into 8, 9, 10, and bad weather could be 12. And you'd still only get home for 2 weeks. But that was what they called a very hard rock. I was at the Skelligs and we were changed up to Dunleary. And we went back from Dunleary and we were at another house. And Brendan was out on the Tirith Lighthouse, which was another awful lighthouse. It's on one of the Blasket Islands. It's a hard lighthouse to get at, and a lot of times Brendan came home and he'd be, you know, his clothes would be all wet because they used to lower them in a, I think it's a bosun's chair, and it was miles down, very high, and miles down to the water. And the small boat there that should have been launched off the relieving ship, when you looked down at it, it was only very small, and they'd have to judge to drop the man into it at the right time. Is, you know, and the boat would be coming up, and sometimes the boat would go down and the sea would be coming, the man would get all wet. Maybe you go to the side of it if the wind took him. I went to Clifton in County Galway and I was delighted because I was 50 miles from home now and I thought this would be heaven. But we were moved after about, I'd say, a year and a half. And we were moved up to Inishowen.
But when I was 7 or almost 8 anyway, we were transferred to Dundalk. That meant all of us uprooting from school. There were 6 in the family at that stage, 6 children. 3, if not 4 of us were at school, primary school, and we transferred to Dundalk. And we lived in the, again, the lighthouse dwellings in the town, or down on the coast near the, just slightly outside the town. My father was in the lighthouse in the bay, a pile light, it was known as. It was on stilts, stilts into the sandbank in the channel coming into Dundalk Bay. But things were changing in the lighthouse service, really, at that point as well, and shortly afterwards. And I don't think families were prepared to make so many moves. And after a number of years on the light in Dundalk Bay, my father was transferred and we didn't move this time. My father moved after that. He moved to Aranmore Lighthouse off the coast of Donegal. He was on Rathlona Burn Lighthouse after that, and he was transferred then to the Kish in Dublin Bay.
Let's see now. 1, 2, 3... 4, 5, 6. But I made a double move in Clifton, say 7. I moved into 7 different houses. And that was, I think I'm right now on that.
Need a windshield,
aren't you? Yeah. We're on the first balcony
As you can see, there's two balconies on the lighthouse. This is the lower one. From here up is completely Irish lights. And as you can see, you have a magnificent view over Waterford Harbour and east towards Kilmore and the Salty Islands. And right north from here, you can see Loftus Hall, the mansion down there where the devil is supposed to have appeared. So the story goes anyway. And due west end, we have Dunmore East. Dunmore East, a major fishing village on the water side of the estuary. And you can see that there's no trees whatsoever on the whole peninsula. And the reason for this, folklore says that the monks cut them all down for the fires here when this was a fire tower. This would have been the actual top of the tower. This was the height of the tower when it was built in 1172. This structure from here that houses the lantern that was built in 1780 when the lantern was constructed. But when they were digging the foundations here for this part, they were supposed to have found the cinders from the fires at this level here, where they would have. Where the monks would have had the fires lit at night. This part was arched up here, and the arches went up about 15 foot, and the arches, it was slitted all around, so the fire could be seen from different points through the slits. So it makes sense, because it would seem to be the only way that you would keep a fire lighting at night up here. There's a reference up in Dublin. Someone discovered in some of the museums a contract for some coal importer to deliver coal to the top here in 1602, and I think it was something like 3/9 or something a ton delivered to the top here.
Can we go up right. To the next level?
It was hard. You were always kind of on your own, and your mind was out on the lighthouse, kind of thinking and wondering. It was an awful wrench every time when he just got ready and left. And as time went on, I don't think it improved anything, because there'd be always tears and, you know, there'd be always saying, I'm going to get a shore job. This was always the thing. Now, shore jobs were scarce in that line. The type of work they did, I mean, what would you get ashore to do? But saying that now, Brendan Orwell said, and all the men in his time, said they were in that job because it was a job, and it was a good job then. But it was a very hard and lonely job too. The really great to have done it, you know, and stuck it out. But they said, well, that was the way it was, and a lot of it was handed down. The father was a lightkeeper, so the son would have been, and two or three of the sons maybe, and that's the way it went down through families. But when he went away, like you were picking up the pieces nearly for a week. You were kind of trying to get things together for nearly a week, and then you were back in your routine again and working your own way. And then he was back again. Great joy when he was coming. All spring cleaning and everything been done. Excitement of knowing. And then again, way again. And then it came to this, with me anyway, it came to the stage that I knew he was coming. And I knew it was going to be long, but that he was going again. And you know, you were pulled and tugged this way and that way. He felt it, and he never wanted to go. There was a week before he went, in the end, he was getting into that lamenting stage, you know.
Mentally, it was pretty hard, and you know, it was the worst time, the first week on the rock then as well. First weekend especially was really hard. After he had left home. But The funny thing about rock life, I found, before the helicopters, when there were boat reliefs and you were maybe 8-9 weeks on a rock, that after 6 weeks, that you were totally institutionalized. And the strange thing about it was that you didn't mind after that length of time. I that's what I found, and a lot of other people will tell you the same thing, that it became easier after 6 or 7 weeks. That, you know, that was your world, and the outside world, it really didn't impinge on you.
Some people would go into long, long silences. Others would prefer, if there was anywhere to walk by themselves on occasions. Others handled it by remaining talking all the time and wanting companionship and whatever. One man became mentally deranged and finished up in a mental asylum.
Dundalk, we were near to the town, although again we lived in the lightkeeper's dwellings, which was a little bit outside of town. Yes, my father was on lighthouse, on the local lighthouse in Dundalk Bay, so he was away for periods of time. And again, when he was transferred after that to, let's say, Arranmore, he would have been away for 6 weeks and home for 2 weeks. So yes, that was a huge change. He tended to, you know, visit the school, let's say, when he came home, just to make sure you were keeping up with your lessons and things like that. He had to make an effort when he came ashore to kind of keep in touch with what we were all doing, I felt.
Then it came to special things like birthdays, which you kind of make the best of. First communions. To be missing for those things, it was hard. And confirmations and different things like that. But as years went by, you found there were terrible problems. Like bringing up children, there were problems. And the father wasn't there. And you had to find the answer and you had to deal with it and everything. And then I discovered as years went on, the father would come home and he'd throw the cat among the pigeons of all you'd have done. And I had to say off and on times, look, you're away all the time and this is the way we work and you'll just have to accept the way we have it here.
There were no phones. We didn't have a phone in our house. And I think getting a phone was a big deal at that time as well. But I remember him when he was ashore, the radio was tuned to shipping stations and, you know, you'd have some obscure tunings there and, you know, shipping forecasts, shipping news, information about Dogger Bank and Finisterre and lots of exotic names coming over the airways. But there was a mark on the radio that at a certain time each day my mother used to tune into. She used to tune the radio into this frequency and this wavelength. And my father used broadcast to the house. He had his own, like a signature tune where he whistled prior to talking. And you'd know at a certain time you tuned into the frequency that this was him. You know, he'd start off with what we used to reckon was kind of lighthouse talk, really. You know, he'd start talking about the weather and ships that might have been passing or what he observed. But he'd soon get down to issuing orders to the kids in the house, just making sure that we were toeing the line. You know, my older brother might have been told to sweep the yard. Somebody else would have been given the job of clearing out drains and getting rid of leaves and so on. Making sure that we got haircuts before he came ashore, this type of thing. It really was an attempt, I felt, well, looking back on it, it was really an attempt by the man to maintain fatherhood or maintain some sort of authority on us kids while he was away.
Come home and he'd try and change it his way. I don't want that long hair and I don't want this. You do this and you do that. Oh, you'd be pulled and tugged, tattered and torn. And many a time when I was leaving him away to Monaghan and Cavan and places, you'd have to get a connection to Donegal. I used to say to him, listen, why can't we have it that you go away in the humour, same good humour you come home in? Everything was great when he came home. There was sweets and bars of chocolate and everything. But going away, there was that kind of a strain. But it was strain on him too. He didn't want to leave. He didn't want to go. He wanted to be home, but he couldn't be. He knew he had to go. I knew he had to go. And it started the week even.
I think I understand some of the stresses the man must have encountered in the job. That it was an attempt really to maintain contact, I suppose, with his own kids. As well as, you could say, impose authority. You know, there was obvious conflicts being away from home and being isolated on lighthouses and trying to pick up the pieces when he came home. But I suppose in retrospect, it was a metaphor for the relationship between the two of us, really. One way broadcasting, really.
And you lived for the month on the rock. You lived for this month or whatever at the time, or a fortnight, whatever it was. And then after, when you were home for your month, after a fortnight, you had this going back again facing you. And the last week or so, you know, you were, they said you weren't, everyone remarked the fact that you weren't in great humour. So it even your month ashore, like, you know, you still had the problem that you were heading back again for another month. And with small kids, like, it was heartbreaking, you know, going away and for a month. Yeah, I remember coming home from Wicklow Head when my son was about two, and he was in one of these walkers. And when I walked in, he disappeared in under the table in the walker, crying. He didn't even know who I was.
Out of 41 Christmases, I had 15 at home. So that wasn't a great record, really. But really, the only time I had full time, let's say, with my family was while I was stationed at Blackhead for 5 years. So for that 5 year period, it was living with the family in the normal way. But other than that, it was fragmented. I found that difficult, especially when the children were small. I found it quite difficult. And in fact, coming home had its difficulties. Because if you threw yourself into your wife's arms, as we usually did, and threw yourself into family life totally for your time ashore, then it was infinitely more difficult to handle the situation of going back on duty. So I always had great difficulty with this. I was always reluctant to commit myself totally to shore life and family and that kind of thing because of the fear of not being able to handle this when you had to leave it. I suppose my family suffered because I wasn't at home. To what degree they suffered because of my slight reticence, I'm not quite sure. I think my children loved me. Hopefully my wife still loves me.
I resented his job. I thought it could be made a lot easier for the men from head office. I thought they were put through an awful lot of hardship that they didn't deserve, first of all, and that needn't have been.
Everybody asks themselves occasionally, what on earth am I doing here? Why am I doing this? But it's only natural that you would, and I don't know, I must have very quickly reconciled myself to the fact that this is what I did, and this is what I was supposed to be good at. That's why they kept me. So, obviously, it was the thing to continue doing. You never, at least I never, failed to appreciate a sunset or a sunrise. You never get used to it. It is a resurrection every morning. It really is. And each night. And probably that was the loneliest time in a lighthouse, at sunset. Because not alone was the sun going down, but it was the start of your night's work.
Now, this was the thing I used to do. I don't know if any other woman or any other person did it. Brendan did it as well. As soon as he arrived in the lighthouse, and as soon as he left the door, I had a book and I'd write. So many days, so many weeks, days, hours, and it should come down to minutes that he was coming home. And you crossed them off. At times I said that was a bad thing to do. And yet when I'd make a break, and I'd say no. It was better that way. I knew that the time was coming down. He seemed to love it in the beginning, and it seemed to be just the last word to him. But the job came before anything else. The job was first. The job was like, well, I suppose most men are that way. The job. He was home in February, and he was to retire in May. The 21st of May was his birthday, so I think that was it. He would be the age then. And he was to retire, but he was to return from the shore duty to Wicklow Head whenever his time was up. I forget how long he had to do, a week, a fortnight, more. But he died on the 15th of February. So he was March, April, May, that much time off retirement when he died. I was absolutely shattered. And the reason for it was, that's what I live for. Every problem, every change of station, everything we did over the years, that was the one thought in my mind. We'll be together when he retires, and this will be the end of this, and we'll be living together when he retires. And I thought we'd do all the things that we couldn't do, you know, that you'd love to do and plan to do.
That's the weight prop now, that the old machine, a weight prop down with that, and had to be rewound every half hour. But we still have a machine up here. This is the focal point of any lighthouse, the lantern, and the lens here are set in a bath of mercury, so you have no friction whatsoever in the revolution as it revolves. And this was the old method of turning the lens, and it still works. It's a their museum piece now. But that had to be rebound every half hour. So it meant that you had to, for your 4 hours of duty, you either sat up here or you went up and down every half hour. So that was a fairly hard task, and up and down those steps. As you see now, we have two electric motors driving the lens at the moment. That was a method of rewinding. That had to be done every half hour. And of course, it had to be kept constant because every light has its character. And this one is a flash every 3 seconds. So it had to be controlled here by the governor. And it had to be spot on to give the light its character, because it would be a serious breach if the light was out of character. And the fog signal is the same. The fog signal has two blasts every 45 seconds. And that's recognizable as well in fog. Now I'll give you a test on this fog signal.
Well, this is the Hook Lighthouse, where my father was born. My grandfather, his father, was a lighthouse keeper here. They were stationed at the Hook when he was born. And shortly afterwards, my grandmother died here. She's buried not too far away from here, so we have connections with this lighthouse, yes. Going back a long way.